visit all the very gay places. Those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails.
Richard Price's latest novel, his eighth, is called Lush Life. It takes place in the gentrifying Lower East Side, where residents of vastly different backgrounds and aspirations lead parallel lives, passing each other on the street every day, but rarely interacting. Then, in the early morning hours, one of the neighborhood's aspiring artists is shot dead by a kid from the projects in a botched robbery, and those worlds collide. Richard Price is the author of Clockers and The Wanderers, numerous screenplays, and was one of the writers of the HBO series The Wire. It is my great pleasure to welcome him back to the show.
Yeah, thanks.
This is the kind of crime we've read about all too frequently in the past decade or so, and it's almost always the case that the murder was unintentional. Why, in your book, does someone describe the crime as death by suicide?
Well, sometimes what happens in that world where you have so many separate cultures, cheek and jowl, a couple of kids from the projects will go to, you know, some Zagat-lined street and put a gun in two kids' faces, and these kids are from the Midwest or from California or something, and they're thinking they're just going to get a couple of $20 bills and go off and get some Chinese food, but what happens is these kids from the Midwest, they have never had a gun in their face before. They're not particularly street smart, and they've been bar hopping. And so one kid will do the right thing, the Desmond Morris, you know, back away, look down, pass over the wallet. The other kid might just think he's in a movie and say something wildly inappropriate or actually make a step towards the gun. The kid with the gun squeezes the trigger, and then you have 5 days of headlines.
The murder victim is Ike Marcus, who is a new arrival in the neighborhood. He's working in a neighborhood bar, hoping for his big break, and he's with some companions when this happens. The most important one is Eric, who does survive. Eric is not exactly the protagonist of this novel, but he is perhaps the key figure.
Well, he's got everybody's attention at any rate afterwards. I mean, they think... First, he was right next to the kid who was killed, and the cops mistakenly think that he did it. And the thing about Eric is that the Lower East Side I'm trying to write about now, at least this La Boheme part of the Lower East Side, there's sort of a tyranny of optimism down there. I mean, everybody's so young. Everybody's going to live forever. Everybody's going to win a Pulitzer or become the new Bill Gates, but with tattoos. And the thing is, they're all in their early 20s. Eric Hash went down there when he was in his early 20s, and now he's 35. And when you're in your early 20s, you'll do jobs like waiter, waitress, maitre d', because you know you're going places, and who cares? And that's how Eric started out being a maitre d', but now 13 years have passed, and all the hyphens after maitre d' have evaporated. And so,
but he still wants to think of himself as an emerging artist. He's going to have his big break.
Yeah, but now he's 35 and he's hanging on by his fingernails, yet he's perpetually surrounded by 13 years younger versions of himself, all who think they're going to live forever, and it's torture for him.
When you were writing it, did you think of Eric as talented, as somebody who could have that big break? Or was that important?
I thought of him as having enough talent to take a shot at it. You know, maybe to get into a writing program somewhere, or you know, to act, you know, get a job doing voiceovers or off Broadway. But you know, I mean, talented people are like asparagus. There's a whole bunch growing out in the field, you know.
And at a certain point, people realize that restaurant management is not just the stopgap job.
Well, there's the thing. There's nothing wrong with being a maitre d' or a waiter or anything if that's what you set out to do, you know, but it's the hyphens that are killing you.
The arc of your career is pretty much the opposite of Eric's. Do you think that he would treat you as kindly in his writing as you've treated him, as sympathetically?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I was trying to be sympathetic to him. He better be sympathetic to me.
You try to be sympathetic to all your characters.
Well, there's no point in... I mean, even the worst character you have to love, otherwise you're never going to be three-dimensional.
The crime has an effect on a wide range of groups in the neighborhood that seldom even have any reason to interact. How would you describe the various groups that inhabit this neighborhood? You've stuck pretty much to what really goes on in the Lower East.
Well, I didn't know what I was going to find when I went down there. My first notion was writing a historical novel about the Lower East Side, because you're required by law to write a historical novel when you're talking about the Lower East Side. And I realized, well, I didn't live down there. Henry Roth did. What am I going to do? But when I went down there, there were about six universes that struck me down there. There's, you know, this young onslaught of 20 something kids, you know, MFAs and MBAs, but you know, there's the housing project culture, which is black and Hispanic. You have the tenements sort of mostly below Delancey Street, which haven't been touched by real estate lava, and they're predominantly Hispanic and Chinese and crackpot geezer hippie. You have the Orthodox Jews, which are a world unto themselves, and you have an enormous population of Fujianese Chinese who are basically living like the Jews lived during Jacob Riis's era, you know, just jam-packed into small apartments, and every penny comes coated in blood and is sent back to the old country or the snakehead that got him in.
There's a scene in the middle of the book where Eric is in the same place as one of the perpetrators of the crime, and the recognition is fleeting. Even the crime doesn't make one group better able to see the other.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, these people occupy the same physical space, but as far as I can tell, the Chinese don't acknowledge the Orthodox Jews, who don't acknowledge the Dominicans, who don't acknowledge, you know, the La Bohemers, who don't acknowledge the blacks, who don't acknowledge the Orthodox. I mean, there's no interaction. I don't even think there's no hostility either. Everybody just sort of, everybody else is sort of a shadow except your own people.
You must have been working on this book while you were writing scripts for The Wire. Could this story just as easily have been set in Baltimore?
Well, it could have just as easily been set anywhere where they're doing, you know, where there's a big plan to regentrify. I mean, one of my themes is real estate is violence. Because you can't convert a neighborhood without uprooting. And I don't even mean, I mean psychically uprooting, physically uprooting. I mean, you're tearing buildings down. There are people that have lived there for a half a century, and all of a sudden there are these stores that don't apply to them on the same street where they would just go to get their toothpaste. You know, and the violence is more psychic than actual, you know, like crime violence.
Well, it's an interesting place, the Lower East Side. For a century, it was a place to get away from. Now it's become a chic destination area. But also, it is a place where people who don't have a lot of money, who've lived there for a long time, are now feeling pushed out. And there's
well,
nowhere for
well,
them
the
to
irony
go.
Is that, you know, it all starts, you know, with the artists. I mean, in terms of what happens to a neighborhood, the artists are looking for a place that's either desolate or has a lot of crime. Nobody wants to live there. They don't have any money. They need a lot of space. They'll mix it up with the locals.
That's what happened in Soho. Yeah. That's what happened in Tribeca.
Well, it happened in Greenwich
Village,
and
then they became very expensive.
Yeah, but you know, and what happens is, all of a sudden, you know, I remember my wife had experienced this in the 70s when she was living in Tribeca before it was called Tribeca. All of a sudden, you know, there's one or two places where you can get really good coffee. There's a bar that'll swap art for a bar tab. And then there'll be a couple of other places. And pretty soon, the realtors will get wind that there's artist chic down there, and then the artist can't afford to live there anymore, so they'll move out. And then the realtors are going, "Hey, fellas, where are you going?" You know, and they'll just follow them until they're in the ocean. I mean, I just came back from Philadelphia. There's a part of Philadelphia called Northern Liberty, which is otherwise known as the Sixth Borough, because it's all filled with artist refugees.
Who could no longer afford Williamsburg, which was
right.
A previous
but you know what?
Where they all went.
Some realtor is going to stick his nose in the wind, and they're just going to go Northern Liberty or whatever the neighborhood's called.
My guest is Richard Price, whose latest novel is Lush Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And why did you give it that title, a Billy Strayhorn song, a classic song?
Well, basically the title came, I just like the phrase. I mean, because what I was writing about is this riot of cultures and this abundance of people centered around a homicide. Just like the irony and you know, the lay of the land. But I didn't really listen to the lyrics until it went off to the printer. And then I finally read the lyrics and I kind of blew that. It was about a bunch of old broads getting hammered at a Third Avenue bar at early in the afternoon. So anyways, I still like the title.
You set your past three novels in a fictional city in New Jersey because you said that you don't want to be obligated to getting a real city exactly right. And what made you change your mind for this?
Well, I've been trying to write about the Lower East Side, you know, all my writing life. And Lower East Side is the main character. It's an entirely different thing. I wanted it to be as ungeneric as possible. I wanted it to be that place. And what got me finally writing there is the fact a couple of years ago to my kids when they were in high school, they knew the Lower East Side better than I did. But what they knew of the Lower East Side was the Knitting Factory, you know, the Pink Pony, a couple of, you know, they knew where to go where you don't get carted. You know, they knew some really cool places to hang out and do clubs and this and that. What they didn't know, or what they were only marginally aware of, is that 110 years earlier, their great-grandfather was probably being put in cuffs for mugging somebody so his mother could get up the $12 rent. And then I realized a lot of these kids that are living down there now, it's a fifth-generation full circle. Their family started out there and moved out, and now the hot place to be is, except they could be living in a $2,000 studio apartment that 12 people lived in, paid $15 rent in 1900, and had trouble coming up with that $15. In 1900, the Lower East Side had the highest population density in the world, including Calcutta.
There's a scene where you describe a photo of a nameless man hung in the basement of a cafe with the words, "Remember Me," written in Yiddish on the wall.
Yeah, well, I kind of made that up. It's called fiction, but not really. I mean, I just studied
but
every...
But it seems real. It could
well,
be
there's
real.
A famous Jacob Riis photo of a man eating, celebrating Sabbath by himself in a coal cellar, and all you can see is his eyes. And it's the most feral thing I've ever seen in my life. And I've been down in those basements below buildings, and I've seen the corner kilns, you know, where families just live wherever they could. And those places are still there. It's just that right above them, the apartment's going for $1 million.
Your books often center on a crime, but I don't think anybody would call you a crime writer or a mystery writer. What is it about that kind of plot that works so well for you?
Well, you know, I think a criminal investigation is a lazy man's way through a plot, and I'm guilty. What it is that...
You're admitting to being lazy?
Yeah, well, all busy people are lazy, don't you know that? I think what happens is I had such a complex landscape, and how do I write about this without feeling like I'm doing a travelogue? Or, you know, I felt like Marlon Perkins, you know? And so how do I get all these disparate cultures in one story? And I realized if you centered on a crime and you follow the logical progression of a criminal investigation, it will, by its very nature, take you everywhere because it'll peripherally touch on everybody.
And the cops touch on everybody because they are there for all the different residents, all these diverse groups.
Right. Well, I mean, basically down there, you know, I mean, their customers are mostly the people in the Lower East Side who haven't gotten the news that they're not supposed to be there yet, so still live there like they did 50 years ago. I mean, you know, they don't read The Onion, you know.
And they view the cops as an occupying force.
Well, I think in most poor neighborhoods. I mean, The Other America said this in 1960, that people perceive the police as an occupying army. And the irony is that on the reverse end of the spectrum, you know, these kids, I mean, they're basically, the cops are doing, you know, well, when are you going to get my bag back? You know, the guy took my bag. Where's my bag? You know, it's like the guy's a babysitter or something. And then you have the Chinese down there who pretty much don't want to have anything in the world to do with the cops. And they're the biggest, you know, victims of muggings.
You use multiple narrative voices and points of view to give us a sense of this diversity. And each one has a distinct voice. Was that part of the problem in working this book out?
No, is because I following this investigation, everybody got a chance to sing their aria, you know, when their name would come up. I mean, if I had a robbery homicide, first thing someone will do will look at robbery patterns and see have there been victims, you know, they don't look at homicides because they figured it was an unintentional homicide. It was a robbery. So they look at the pattern reports and see if there have there been victims that have been like two guys this time of night. That are, and they come up with three people, two Chinese people and one Israeli. And each person has to be re-interviewed. And that's my excuse to give voice.
Your approach to dialogue has been praised for being extremely realistic by some and fabulously invented by others.
Yeah, I'll never write another word of dialogue again after these reviews.
But what do you think? People just loved the dialogue on The Wire and said that it was about the most realistic thing that they'd ever heard.
See, the irony is that the most realistic is the least realistic. People don't really talk. I mean, it's the illusion of you're a fly on a wall and this is how people really talk. The way people really talk, it's like the world's worst Beckett play. People never finish their thoughts. They circle back on themselves. The John Gotti FBI basement tapes from the Ravenite Social Club. I mean, the real Sopranos, these guys were talking, his crew, for 45 minutes and you fell asleep on page 3 of the transcripts. I mean, good dialogue is compressed dialogue. It's juked dialogue. It's heightened reality. You're giving it a veneer of coherence, but in fact, the way people talk, you couldn't follow it.
We hope for that veneer of coherence on talk shows, but we are the exception. This book is pretty big. It's 450 pages long, and yet I have to tell you, it felt kind of lean to me, which I'm sure was your intention, but I gathered that there were 300 more pages.
Yeah, well, the problem with my writing is that I look at that world and I don't want to throw anything out, but you know, it becomes like this. You don't want to check your bag on a plane. You want to stuff it overhead, but every time you see something you say, oh, that should go in a bag. And it became huge. And but also as I got older, I think I realized that I don't need to say things 8 times to get them across.
I remember William Styron being asked about cutting 300 pages from a novel, and they said, did we lose a lot of interesting plot? He said, no, just mostly adjectives and adverbs.
Yeah, a couple of commas, too. I mean, and dialogue marks. But
there were no subplots that I'm going to be sorry to have missed.
There's a couple of things I still wince about. But, Jonathan Galassi told me, sort of console me, he said, I think it was Robert Lowell said, sometimes I have to delete my best lines to save my poem.
So where do you go next? Because you have been writing for television, The Wire. I'm sure you're going to miss that a little bit. You've been writing screenplays all along. In fact, that's been kind of your day job. And 8 novels. What's next?
Well, I got to go back to my day job. You know, baby needs a new pair of shoes.
This book is going to sell very well, Richard.
Yeah, but it's a book. You know, screenplays sell. You know, I don't have that many ideas in me. And I like alternating between screenplays and novels. I'm doing a screenplay for this book coming out called Child 44. It's a sort of a Russian thriller.
Did the screenplays feed the novels?
No, but the screenplays gave me something that I'll be forever grateful for. Screenplays told me I do not have to, I can write about things other than my own autobiography. I can go out and I can learn things and I can bring them back home.
Well, one of the big differences, you told me on a screenplay, if there's more type than there is white space, you've done something wrong, but that's not true.
Yeah, no, if your page looks like that obelisk at the beginning of 2001 Space Odyssey, you know, nobody's going to read it because the cameras, you can just lock the camera on and the director can go get a sandwich and then come back sometime later and say cut. There's nothing for him to do. It's too static.
Richard Price will be giving a reading and signing books tonight and talking with David Simon later as well. At 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. He'll also be talking at other places throughout April. You can find out all about them by going to our show page for details at WNYC.org. And the book we've been talking about is called Lush Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And thank you so much for coming by again, Richard.
Well, thanks for having me.